On Wall Street today, it's a big old Groupon pylon.
And the American consumer resurfaces. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. It is Tuesday, August the 14th. Lots of good stuff coming up. Among the items, we'll talk about that shadow inventory. Remember that term, Jeremy, that we used to mention a lot? All these foreclosed homes that banks were holding back and that they were going to have to release those onto the market like a flood, and that was going to prevent the housing recovery. Well, what happened to that shadow inventory? We will find out.
Also, we'll talk with the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, who is calling on the Fed to do more monetary stimulus to try to get employment numbers looking better in this country. We'll have that conversation coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Happiness is all relative in Europe these days. Investors seem to cheer news that the euro area's top economies did not turn in the abysmal results that many had expected. Instead, things are just garden variety bad. France's economy did not shrink in the second quarter. Quite the contrary, France posted a growth rate of zero. German GDP grew at the brisk pace of 0.3%. The output of all the nations of the euro together contracted 0.2%. The BBC's Steve Evans is with us with more from Berlin. Hello.
Good day to you.
Well, let's start with where you are. What's driving the flagging performance of the German economy?
The German economy is still not in recession. It's bumping along above zero, but still only about half the rate of growth that it was at the start of the year. Mm-hmm. And that's because Germany is selling very well in China, very well in Asia, successful economy, but 40% of German trade is with the rest of the Eurozone. So the weak economies of the Mediterranean are German markets, and because they're flat and worse than flat, Germany's being brought down. That's the gist of it.
As Germany is brought down, what are you sensing from Germans on the street? Is this a bit of a wake-up call?
I think it is a wake-up call. I think it'll harden their attitude to giving money through bailouts. I think these figures out today will increase the demands from France, for example, for stimulus and increase the resistance of Germans towards giving that stimulus.
Let's talk about France. It appears that flat growth is actually cause for some celebration there. It doesn't sound too great to me. What do the new numbers say about France's economic situation?
Celebration? Well, they were expecting worse. They were expecting it to actually shrink. So they're kind of celebrating that it wasn't even worse. I'm not sure they're celebrating much there because they know they've got some pretty tough choices on the way. President Hollande came in saying that growth was the top of his agenda, but he also wants to balance budgets. He's going to have to start looking at things like cuts in expenditure or rises in taxation soon. We've got a sense here that we're now getting to the new year, as it were. We all come back from our vacations and we start thinking hard.
The BBC's Steve Evans in Berlin. Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
We learned this morning that retail sales in the U.S. jumped by almost 1% last month. That was the first uptick in 4 months as consumers spent more money on everything from cars to electronics. Julie Neiman is analyst with Smith Moore & Company. She's with us now to dissect these numbers. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, so what's going on here, Julie?
Well, to quote Martha Stewart, it's a good thing. This is the best since February. Shoppers are buying in all categories, not just food and pharmacy and gasoline, which, by the way, rose not just on price hikes, but volume. America's finally hitting the road again. Furniture, appliances, electronics, even I joined that conga line and bought my first laptop. Home economics, we're looking at still continuing to fix up with building materials and hardware, and even the shopping malls, which house the barking dogs of the industry, the department stores, are repopulating with real shoppers, not wearing sweatsuits. It's not just the morning walkers and the teens cruising around. Leisure time was very big. Sports, hobbies, bookstores. So it was across the board and a real positive.
Well, why are shoppers joining the conga line, as you say? Why is everybody going back to the stores?
Well, the big part is consumer confidence, and it is up. Jobs aren't getting worse. They're not really swell here, but they're confident that they're going to keep their jobs, so they're loosening the purse strings a little bit. Wages are actually seeing some rises. Consumer incomes are ticking up a bit. Debt levels are still comparatively high, but it's seen as manageable now. And retailers are still very promotional. Sale, it's the loveliest four-letter word in the English language. It's still there.
Quick question, Julie. Groupon is out this morning we're seeing their stock down 20% or so after a disappointing earnings report. What's going on?
Well, it's the source of the earnings. It came from stuff, not experiences. So they're trying to be competitive with Amazon and everybody else who's out peddling cheap stuff. So it's the source of the earnings that's really hitting them here. That and maybe America's finally paying full price to go out to lunch.
Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith Moore & Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
Quick check of the markets. Looks like it was an up day in Asia today, especially in Hong Kong, where the Hang Seng Index rose more than 1%. In Europe as well, sort of modest excitement, you might say, that things weren't worse. Germany's DAX Index up 0.7%, and the U.S. markets a little more chill. All the major indices at this hour getting off to a start at up about 0.2%.
The latest news about the housing market comes today from Home Depot. The nation's largest home improvement chain says its profit was up 12% last quarter thanks to cost cutting and a jump in U.S. sales. That jump, of course, means more people are sprucing up their homes. On the other hand, what about all that shadow housing inventory we've heard about that's supposed to keep prices down for a while? Shannon Mullen has that story.
The thing about a shadow, it can look a lot scarier than the object that's casting it.
The big elephant in the room of shadow inventory has gone on a diet over the last 18 months.
Darren Blomquist is vice president of Realty Track, a website that counts and markets foreclosure properties. He says some analysts worried up to 10 million delinquent mortgages, foreclosures, and bank-owned homes would hover off the market indefinitely, depressing prices and prospective buyers.
The doomsday scenario hasn't played out yet.
Instead, shadow inventory peaked at just over 2 million homes in 2008. And now the tracking firm CoreLogic says it's down to 1.5 million. Blomquist says, number one, banks are helping more homeowners avoid foreclosure. Some lenders don't have a choice, thanks to growing state and federal pressure. And turns out, keeping people in their homes can also be better for a bank's bottom line.
The letter of suspension, when we suspended the foreclosure, that's all in here. Legal bills paid.
At the savings bank in Wakefield, Massachusetts, senior loan officer Kathleen Beaulieu rifles through a thick file for a delinquent loan she recently modified.
We're not in the real estate business. We're in the money business. The bank does not make any money by foreclosing on somebody's home and selling the property.
But banks are increasingly letting people sell homes worth less than they owe. That's because more buyers are looking for bargains, including investors who buy in bulk. So short sales are up, while foreclosure filings are down year over year. But Realty Track's Darren Blomquist says nearly 13 million borrowers are still underwater.
Right now, those homeowners are behaving well and making their mortgage payments, the vast majority of them.
If they stay current as the economy grows, Blomquist says there won't be much of a shadow left to keep the housing market from really heating up. In Boston, I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
Well, Jeremy, shares of Groupon this morning continue to be kind of like a traffic accident that it's very hard to look away from.
Yeah.
It's been bad, bad news for them. Yesterday was a rough day, and then today, Groupon share price is down right now about 23%. That puts them off about 70% from the IPO price back in November. The company announced earnings late yesterday that clearly disappointed. For more, we've got Jack Vonderheide. He's president of Technology Briefing Centers, a tech industry research firm. Good to talk with you.
Same here, Jeff.
So Groupon just declared a profit for the first time. This is what people have been waiting for, right? What are investors so upset about?
Well, investors in this sector are really looking for exponential growth and profits and revenues that are way beyond those of any other industry. So while Groupon performed, in my opinion, exceptionally well, the Street does not view it that way for this particular sector.
Sounds like the Street is upset about how Groupon was making its money. What's the problem there?
Well, Groupon got into a different area of business. They're actually selling consumer items as opposed to simply selling deals. And the profitability on these types of transactions tends to be lower than the profitability on daily deals.
The rap on Groupon, even from way before it went public, was that anyone could do this. It was way too easy to replicate. Seems to me that Groupon is still the far dominant brand name in this daily deals business.
Oh, absolutely. While the concept is simple, the execution is quite difficult indeed, and you've really got to be on top of your game to make it work. And that's where Groupon has really done an excellent job. And as you mentioned, they are the dominant force. I mean, they're the Band-Aid or the Kleenex of their industry and the service.
Clearly, you have plenty of residual belief in Groupon, but there are many investors who think there is something very, very wrong with this company at this point. What do you think they have to do to retrench and get on a better track?
Well, I think Groupon needs to show consistent profitability, and they've done a great job for this quarter, in my opinion, but they need to show that quarter after quarter after quarter, and it's going to take time. The second thing they need to do is they need to go further down the path of developing a consultative sales force rather than a deal-focused sales force. They need to get closer to their merchant customers and then sharply target the Groupons to address those needs, more of a rifle approach rather than a shotgun approach.
Jack Vonderheide with Technology Briefing Centers, a man with some faith in Groupon. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jeff.
Jeremy, you've heard of 3D printing? Maybe talked about it on the show, right?
No. What is 3D printing?
Okay. Well, yeah, it's in tech circles. This is like getting lots and lots of attention. I think our Marketplace Tech Report is getting really into it. Anyway, it's, well, you know, a printer prints a picture on a piece of paper, two dimensions. Well, 3D printing is printing an object, basically. A device
wow.
that prints a three-dimensional right. object.
So, like just a donut or something comes out of the printer.
Yeah, I don't think you can eat it. It may not have advanced to quite that level, but, you know, out of plastic or other materials. And these devices are getting down, you know, for $1,000. You can get a cheap one now. So people and businesses are finding lots of new uses for these.
Wow.
And just a couple of notable 3D printing advances rolled across my desk this week. I'm going to share them with everybody. An engineer at USC demonstrated that you could make a house using nothing but 3D printing. So there's just one hitch to it. The 3D printer required would have to be bigger than a house. So other than that, it's a piece of cake. And the other one is also kind of fascinating. On a much smaller scale, for $1,200, a clinic in Tokyo is giving prospective parents the option of a 3D printed life-size model of their fetus. So, I mean, it's both beautiful and kind of weird.
Wow. That's going a little too far, I think.
Yeah. You know, and I can't help but think, you know, once you actually, a few months later, you have the real thing, which is still way cooler, you might kind of wonder why you spent all that money on the plastic preview version.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Well, you can bet those retail sales figures and housing figures we talked about are being pored over this morning at the Federal Reserve. So are the latest growth figures out of Europe. The Fed's policymakers need all that information to try and live up to both of their mandates, keeping prices stable and keeping employment full. One of those policymakers is Eric Rosengren, who heads the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. He's with us now for an extended midday extra interview. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be with you, Jeremy.
Great to have you. Well, let's start with the economy. I mean, how would you describe our economy right now, how it's doing?
Well, I would describe our economy as treading water. At the beginning of the year, we started with 8.3% unemployment, and the July employment report, which came out last week, also had 8.3% unemployment. So there's really been no improvement in labor markets over the last 7 months. In addition, the percent of the population that's employed and the labor force participation rate has been roughly the same as it was in the beginning of the year. So that's kind of a treading water. If I look at GDP, which are the goods and services produced in the economy, the first quarter was only 2% growth. The second quarter was 1.5% growth. So the economy slowed down. Much of that is because the global economy has slowed down and because there are significant concerns about fiscal austerity both here and abroad and what's happening in Europe. Those concerns have caused both households and businesses to cut back on spending that they might otherwise be making. And as a result, if you look at the GDP report, I'd make the analogy that we're treading water but taking a few gulps in the lake, that it's really time to try to get more growth, to get more improvement in the labor market, in effect, a swim to shore.
So why didn't the Fed step in at its most recent meeting with more monetary stimulus?
It made sense to wait until we got this employment report to confirm that we were doing no better than treading water. And it makes sense to get a sense of what's happening in the global economy as well. But my own view is at this point we have enough information that has confirmed that it doesn't look like we're going to pick up in the second half of the year. My own expectation is that the second half of the year won't be much better than the first half because the drivers of fiscal austerity and European problems aren't likely to be resolved in the next two quarters, and that monetary policy shouldn't wait any further before reacting to the global slowdown that we've been encountering.
But can monetary policy step in and fill the void where fiscal austerity is taking place? I mean, is it just you take away one and you can put in the other?
So it's not filling in the void, but it's helped mitigating some of the factors that are buffeting the economy right now. So there are a number of ways that monetary policy works, but it can affect both the housing sector, consumption, and business fixed investment. And all those can be an important driver to making sure that rather than having an economy that's growing no better than 1.5 to 2%, we get a better outcome than that.
Now, you want the Fed to sort of change the way that it does these big bond purchases called quantitative easing. And instead of sort of setting the limits up front on how many bonds it's going to buy, you want your colleagues at the Fed to just keep buying until they see results in the labor market.
So the focus not only for quantitative easing, but I think also on any kind of forward guidance for how long interest rates stay low should be focused on the economic outcomes that we want. So we should be focused on getting growth in income that is satisfactory and that results in a labor market that is improving. So I would have any of our programs, whether it's forward guidance or whether it's quantitative easing, tied to getting the right kind of economic outcomes before we stopped. So I would want a substantial program if we did quantitative easing, and I would tie it to getting the kind of income growth that we want or tie it to getting clear improvements in the labor market.
You think that you can see a direct connection at some point between the Fed pumping money into the economy, essentially, and somebody getting a job somewhere?
I do. Any of our models would indicate that some of the programs that we've already done have provided some stimulus to the economy. It's probably not the growth that we wanted, and unfortunately, the economy's been buffeted by factors that we couldn't completely offset, such as what's been going on in Europe. And in fact, in the absence of some of the European problems, I think we would have more of a self-sustaining recovery right now. I certainly think that additional monetary policy accommodation can make a difference, can make sure that the economy grows faster than it would in the absence of the policy, and that we get a better outcome for labor markets.
But what about the idea that these jobs that are created just from that kind of thing may not be the jobs that we need in the future, that this is not going to retrain somebody into a new business that's going to be a real part of our economic future?
So this isn't the only policy we should be looking at to improving the labor markets, but it's what the Federal Reserve can do. So areas that I agree are important are thinking about retraining the labor force and making sure that people can get the kind of jobs that provide a sustainable lifestyle. But a lot of those programs are in the realm of fiscal policy, which the Monetary Authority has no control over.
Do you think that Congress has dropped the ball in terms of fiscal policy for the last couple of years?
I think it would be very useful to have more clarity on what the potential spending cuts and what the potential tax increases will be. So the uncertainty about what the rules of the game are going to be next year, I think, are causing some households and some businesses to defer decisions. And when households and businesses defer decisions, that shows up in slower economic growth.
Now, what about the risks that your counterparts on the other side of the ideological spectrum would bring up, which is that we may at some point have a big inflation problem and it could come quickly and without warning if you keep putting more stimulus into the economy?
One of the concerns surrounding the Federal Reserve expanding its balance sheet has been that we would induce inflation. We first expanded our balance sheet in the fall of 2008 and then with our two quantitative easing programs. Despite the fact that we've expanded our balance sheet quite substantially, and we've had more than 4 years since we started those programs, we're still seeing an inflation rate below our 2% target. So for total PCE inflation, which is the inflation target that the Federal Reserve is tied to, It's only been growing at 1.5% over the last year. And if you look at that same measure, taking out food and energy, it's 1.8%. That just highlights that despite the fact that we have taken expansionary policy over the last several years, we've yet to see the inflation that some are concerned about.
What about the idea that it could change quickly?
We've been waiting for 4 years. In order for it to change quickly, you'd have to see a very rapid expansion in lending. You'd start seeing evidence in banking markets. We're just not seeing that evidence.
When you go to work every day, do you feel like you're in uncharted territory, or do you look at this economic situation that we're in and say, we've been here before, I can look back to this point in time and say, this is what will happen if we do this?
We're certainly in uncharted water. We're doing unconventional policy for a reason, that we've kind of exhausted the conventional policies that we normally would do. So normally the Federal Reserve focuses on the federal funds rate, a short-term interest rate that we can move up or down depending on what's happening in the economy. Those rates are now bound by zero, so we have to be doing other types of monetary policy. Some of them have been tried in other countries or in different circumstances, but the effects of these kind of policies are more uncertain than our more traditional tools. So there is a reason for some caution and not to rush to make changes using unconventional policy. But I think the length of time that we've been stagnant in the economy calls for us to once again try to use some of those unconventional tools.
Do you think that politics are at play right now? Is the Fed scared to act because it thinks that its actions will be seen as political?
An independent Federal Reserve should be focused on the business cycle, not the political cycle, and that's what I'm focused on.
Do you think your colleagues feel the same way?
Can't speak for anybody but myself.
How long do you think it's going to take until we are out of this economic slump that we've been in for the last several years? When will we be able to look forward and say, you know what, the U.S. economy is doing great and we are back on top again?
It's going to be a number of years before we're back to full employment. I think the appropriate monetary and fiscal policies can make a big difference on how quickly we get to that point. But there's certainly things that we can't control. What happens in China and whether China's slowing and what kind of policies they do, we have no control over. What's happening in Europe and the very serious problems that they're trying to address, we have no control over. So part of these, there are factors that are outside our control. But in the absence of some of these other issues, I think taking the right policies, we will get much stronger growth than we would in the absence of those policies.
Eric Rosengren is president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed the interview.
And now a correction to a story we aired yesterday. We reported that Representative Paul Ryan, the vice presidential candidate, made some personal stock trades back in 2008 on a day when congressional leaders met with then-Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson about a possible Wall Street bank bailout. Well, according to the Romney campaign, the trades were not made by Mr. Ryan himself, and the meeting, which the Romney campaign says Mr. Ryan did not attend, took place after the markets closed.
Well, the presidential campaign is dominated by talk about jobs, Wall Street, the deficit, especially now that Paul Ryan is in the race. One perennial subject is kind of lost in the shuffle, immigration reform. Well, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg is running his own sort of campaign to try to change that. He'll hit events today in Chicago and Boston. Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
Mayor Bloomberg hopes to draw awareness to what he considers dysfunctional federal immigration policies. John Feinblatt is Mayor Bloomberg's chief policy advisor.
We've got policies in this country that are just shooting ourselves in the foot. We educate foreign students in science, technology, engineering, and math, and then when we hand them their diploma, we also hand them a one-way ticket back to their country.
Each year, the U.S. issues around 70,000 visas for highly skilled workers. That number falls to 10,000 for entrepreneurs, and those visas are more restrictive. Dimitri Papadimitri is president of the Migration Policy Institute.
All of which make it more difficult for people to be able to invest in the United States.
He says the U.S. competes for the most talented workers with countries like Canada and the U.K. Those countries fine-tune their visa policies almost annually. By contrast, the U.S. hasn't significantly changed immigration policies in over 20 years. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Well, the official cost of the London Olympics is about $15 billion. The benefits to be determined. But some of the city's small business owners are already seeing red, as Christopher Worth reports.
Lambert Souvenirs is exactly the kind of business you'd expect to benefit from the Olympics. A shot put throw from the Houses of Parliament, it sells all the memorabilia a tourist could ever ask for.
T-shirts, sweatshirts, keyrings, magnets, and pins.
Frey Derger works here. In the run-up to the Games, she says the store is stocked up on merchandise, expecting a flood of visitors, which it now regrets.
We're not selling anything. We're not selling our souvenirs. Everybody's complaining business is down by 55 to 60% because no customers are coming.
Complaints like hers can be heard all over London. It seems high hotel prices and the hassle of the Olympics have scared off many of the normal non-Olympic visitors. Mary Rance is the head of UK Inbound, a trade association for the tourism industry. She says August is usually a peak month for tourism in London, but close to 90% of tourism-related businesses are reporting losses due to lower-than-expected visitor numbers during the Games.
And obviously, as the number of visitors are down, obviously it means the bookings in hotels are down, the visits to attractions are down, so it has a sort of spiralling effect.
Spiralling all the way down to the little guy on the street.
It's been a great Olympic for Britain, but not for us.
Arben Leshy draws portraits and caricatures on this sidewalk in London's West End shopping district. He says he'd usually have about 10 to 15 customers a day, but this summer he's had days when no one stops.
I know what the business is like in the summer here, and if I look at my books and compare it to the previous summer, it's been completely 70% off.
He says he's got just a few more weeks before the summer season ends, but he doesn't think he can earn enough to make up the difference by then. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
And finally, during the Olympic gold medal basketball game, Jeff, NBC's camera panned the crowd and they found the face of a guy that looked like Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg.
He could afford to make the trip, I would think.
Exactly. And right. They were very excited about that, the announcers were. Here's the audio from the website Deadspin.
We've got every executive of note, it seems, worldwide attending these games.
Well, it turns out it was not Mr. Zuckerberg, the executive. He doesn't have quite as famous a face as the founder of Facebook ought to have. Mm-hmm. It was actually the actor Jesse Eisenberg who played Mark Zuckerberg in the movie The Social Network.
That is awesome. I just
thought it was him.
Oh, my gosh. You know, and of course, I guess that speaks to the savvy casting that they did for that movie. But
I guess so. But also it speaks to the fact that maybe Zuckerberg needs a few more Facebook friends so that people can know what he looks like in reality.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.